Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, we are really digging into what feels like, well, maybe the most intense period of federal government activity and institutional warfare we've seen in a long time.
That's right.
The title of this deep dive is The Federal News Update for Tuesday, October 21st, 2025.
And our mission really is to dissect these last 72 hours. Since October 19th, we've just seen these major interconnected actions, you know, across all three branches.
It's a lot. Shutdowns, executive orders reconfiguring whole departments, global strategy shifts.
Exactly. It's defined by this historic shutdown, this sort of radical executive reconfiguration of the civil service we're seeing, and these really high-stakes global realignments. It's almost like a study in strategic chaos.
Yeah, strategic chaos is a good way to put it. The pace is just staggering. So we need to move past the headlines and really unpack the granular details. Every significant event, from, you know, the 11th failed vote to open the government, all the way to this massive new critical minerals pact with Australia, we need to analyze the profound and likely lasting implications of all these colliding events.
Where do we even start?
Let's start right where the deadlock is deepest. The shutdown crisis. It's now barreling into its fourth week.
Okay. Yeah, legislative paralysis really defines this moment, doesn't it? On Monday, October 20th, the Senate voted yet again.
The 11th time.
11th time, right. Voted against the House-passed continuing resolution, the CR, that was supposed to fund the government through late November. And the vote, well, it was pretty predictable. 50-43 failure.
Nowhere near the 60 votes needed to break a filibuster.
Not even close.
And the sticking point, again, it's these Affordable Care Act tax credits, the enhanced subsidies that are about to expire.
That's it.
This isn't just some minor policy disagreement, is it? Democrats, led by Senator Schumer, are framing this as a looming healthcare catastrophe. It's their absolute line in the sand.
They insist any funding bill, any CR, has to fix this ACA cliff.
In Schumer's position, it really stems from the potential human impact, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about tens of millions of working and middle-class Americans, people who are facing these massive, potentially unaffordable premium spikes. I mean, when you dive into the actual data, the scale is just, it's huge.
Like, what kind of numbers are we talking?
Well, for older couples, for instance, premiums could jump by, you know, $500, $600, maybe even $1,000 per month.
Wow. That is life-altering cost inflation per month.
Exactly. And in some states, like Idaho, estimates show maybe 100,000 people could lose coverage entirely. It's unaffordable. For some families, the annual cost increase could top
$24,000. $24,000.
Yeah, it's like an economic bomb just waiting to go off. And Democrats argue they just can't, you know, in good conscience, pass a funding bill that ignores this ticking clock. A clock, granted, they themselves kind of set up with the way the law was written.
Because that's the core of the GOP counterargument, isn't it?
Right.
Republican leadership Senator Thune, specifically, they refuse to even negotiate on policy until the government is reopened. They're framing this ACA cliff as a Democrat-created problem.
Yeah. They point out Democrats passed the bill, they implemented the credits, and they chose the sunset date unilaterally.
So the GOP views this as Democrats holding the government hostage.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Holding it hostage to force a political bailout from their own legislative choices. Senator Thune has been really clear. Fund the government first, then we can talk policy.
Yeah.
And the political leverage they get from that stance is huge.
Especially when you look at the House.
Right, the House in action. Speaker Mike Johnson has very strategically kept the House in this extended recess since back in September, September 19th.
And that wasn't an accident.
No, no. It's a tactic. It focuses all the negative political heat, all the pressure, squarely onto the Senate Democrats.
And Johnson kind of added fuel to that fire, didn't he, with that comment?
Oh, the king comment. Yeah, he ironically claimed that if President Trump was a king, the government would be open.
Which is a direct jab at the whole no kings protest rhetoric.
Exactly. Trying to weaponize the shutdown itself as proof that, you know, executive efficiency is being stifled by legislative gridlock.
But the GOP isn't just sitting back during the recess. Thune's got another move planned this week.
That's right. Senator Thune plans to force a vote, probably Wednesday or Thursday, on piecemeal legislation.
Piecemeal? What does that mean?
It means it's not a full funding bill. This bill is specifically designed just to fund the military and pay those accepted federal employees, the ones forced to work without pay.
So it's a political squeeze play.
Classic tactic, yeah. It tries to peel off moderate Democrats, forces them into a tough vote against funding the troops, and ramps up the pressure by making the Democrats' ACA demands look like the only thing standing in the way of essential services.
This political stalemate, though, it's having really serious, almost terrifying operational consequences. It's not just numbers on a budget sheet.
Not at all.
Let's look at that operational and human toll, starting with, well, the National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA.
Okay, yeah, this is deeply concerning. On Monday, October 20th, the NNSA furloughed about 1,400 federal employees.
1,400? How much of their staff is that?
That's over three-quarters of its staff, over 75%.
Yeah.
This is a dramatic, dramatic escalation in risk.
Three-quarters of the nuclear security staff furloughed. What on earth does that mean for, like, our actual nuclear safety and readiness?
It's frankly shocking. And critically, it's unprecedented. This is the first time in the NNSA's entire 25-year history that it has furloughed workers during a shutdown.
The first time.
The first time. In previous shutdowns, there were always mechanisms, carve-outs, to protect essentially all national security personnel. The fact that the NNSA, the agency responsible for securing and modernizing our nuclear stockpile, is taking this step, it signals either a new level of budget desperation or maybe a fundamental operational collapse under the strain.
Have lawmakers reacted?
Oh, yeah. Immediately. People like Representative Daniotaitis voiced serious concerns. They're saying this severely undercuts national security readiness, it stalls crucial modernization efforts, and it's basically a gift to our strategic competitors.
How many staff are actually left working there?
Fewer than 400. Left to secure the entire nuclear stockpile.
Fewer than 400.
There is one small exception, though. The NNSA's Office of Secure Transportation, the folks who actually move nuclear material, they remain funded. But only through some complex budget gymnastics, as they called it, until October 27th. So even that's temporary. But the core scientific staff, the maintenance staff, they're decimated.
Wow. Okay, and this operational pain, it's not just in highly secure facilities, it's hitting millions of ordinary travelers too, right? Through aviation disruptions.
Absolutely. Over the weekend, it was chaos at airports. We saw roughly 19,000 delayed flights between Saturday and Monday.
19,000.
Yeah, and nearly 8,000 delays on Sunday alone.
And the cause is directly the shutdown.
Direct result. Staffing shortages among air traffic controllers, ATCs. They're accepted, so they're essential. They have to work, but they're not getting paid.
Highly skilled, high-stress job, working for free.
Precisely. And Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy issued a really stark warning. He said these disruptions could escalate dramatically as the next full payday approaches this Friday, when people realize they're not getting that check.
The threat is the so-called sick outs, right? People just calling in sick en masse.
That's the big fear. Morale is just cratering. You have ATCs working these grueling shifts, zero compensation. It's increasingly likely they'll just start calling in sick. And that cripples the system because there's no reserve staff to cover those shifts.
So Secretary Duffy is worried about a nationwide travel stoppage.
He openly worried about it escalating into that, which would, of course, create immense pressure on Congress to do something. But it's a morbid situation.
Mm-hmm.
Lawmakers are kind of dreading that it might take a major aviation accident, something caused by these staffing shortfalls, to actually force the politicians in D.C. to negotiate seriously.
That's a terrifying thought. What about the federal employees themselves? The 1.6 million, 900,000 furloughed, 700,000 working without pay. They missed a partial check already.
And now they face missing a full paycheck this Friday.
The human cost there must be immense, especially for those not on high salaries.
It is, and it's often hidden in these bureaucratic details.
Mm.
Take the accepted employees at the Social Security Administration, the SSA. Many are on the lower end of the general schedule pay scale. They really rely on every single dollar.
Okay.
And in this chaos, many have lost their parking subsidies, their transit benefits. Just getting to work becomes unaffordable. So they ask for basic accommodations, like maybe episodic telework, just short-term remote work for a specific circumstance, or even just unpaid leave because they can't afford the commute.
And those requests are being denied.
Often denied by managers who are themselves overwhelmed or perhaps following strict directives. And here's the really vicious part. If they can't afford to show up, they get marked AWOL, absent without leave.
AWOL? That sounds serious.
It is serious. It's a form of disciplinary action. Now, normally, Congress passes a law after a shutdown to guarantee full back pay for everyone affected.
Right.
But those back pay laws typically exclude employees who were subject to disciplinary action during the shutdown, like being marked AWOL or suspended.
Wait, so by denying leave or telework, the agencies could actually be preventing their lowest paid employees from getting their back pay later?
That's the cruel logic, yes. It essentially threatens to strip these employees of their guaranteed compensation and risks further disciplinary action that could jeopardize their long-term federal careers. It's like punishing the workforce for the failures of the institution itself.
A remarkable level of institutional cruelty seems like the right phrase. Is there any support happening? Community efforts?
There are. On a more positive note, the community response has been pretty swift. The Capital Area Food Bank, for example, started additional food distributions this week, specifically targeting federal workers and contractors hit by the shutdown.
That's good to hear.
An American University's School of Public Administration offered free career planning and networking programs for furloughed feds, which is interesting because the feedback wasn't really about the job advice itself.
No, what was it about?
Participants said it was more about feeling seen, about having a place to go just to get out of the house while facing this crippling stress. Some were already contemplating leaving public service entirely.
And that sense of desperation, that institutional fatigue, it feels like that's being strategically exploited by the executive branch, doesn't it?
It really does.
While Congress is stuck in this paralysis, the executive branch seems to be moving very aggressively to reconfigure the federal workforce, almost using the shutdown to, as you said earlier, clear the ground.
Yeah, this is where the narrative really shifts. It goes from political failure in Congress to very deliberate, strategic administrative action from the White House. On October 20th, the administration published this landmark executive order. It's titled Ensuring Continued Accountability in Federal Hiring.
And what does it do?
It formalizes and indefinitely extends a nationwide federal hiring freeze.
Okay, a hiring freeze. What are the key operational parts of that order?
Well, first, it prohibits filling most vacancies across the government. But second, and this is a really crucial part, it mandates that all new hiring must be approved by these newly established senior hiring committees, or SHCs.
Senior hiring committees composed of political appointees.
Explicitly composed of political appointees, not career human resources professionals.
So this sounds like the mechanism for that political purging people have been worried about. Is this the functional replacement for the previous administration's failed attempt to implement Schedule F?
It certainly looks like the successor strategy, yes. And the timing during the shutdown is perfect for them. This order fundamentally changes the definition of merit in the federal service. The administration is explicitly stating they're seeking individuals who are, and I quote, passionate about the ideals of our American Republic. That shifts the filter away from professional competence, the traditional nonpartisan civil service standard, towards ideological suitability.
Okay, so let me see if I understand the process. The shutdown and these planned layoffs, the RAFs, they create vacancies.
Right.
The hiring freeze stops career professionals from filling those spots through the normal channels.
Correct.
And then these new senior hiring committees, staffed by politicals, get to vet candidates based on their ideology to repopulate the agencies.
That's exactly the sequence. And critics are absolutely sounding the alarm. They're calling it a direct, systemic attempt to dismantle the nonpartisan bureaucracy and essentially staff the agencies with political loyalists.
Which could lead to a massive brain drain of expertise and institutional knowledge.
Just when it's arguably needed most, yes.
And speaking of those vacancies,
Yeah.
the Department of the Interior has revealed some pretty massive layoff plans, these RIFs, or reductions in force.
Huge numbers. Interior plans to lay off more than 2,000 employees.
2,000. Where are those cuts falling?
Let's break it down. About 770 are slated to go from headquarters and the business centers. But the cuts also really target the core scientific mission. 335 staff members are being cut from the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS.
The USGS, why is that cut so significant?
Well, the USGS is basically the bedrock of a lot of American scientific research. They manage critical data on water resources, energy reserves, earthquakes, climate change. I mean, their data feeds into everything from insurance risk modeling to infrastructure planning.
Still cutting them.
Critics warn it would eviscerate the core science of the USGS. And on top of that, there are significant cuts hitting field offices. 474 at the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, 272 at the National Park Service, NPS, That could devastate their regional planning capacity, especially for big infrastructure and conservation projects.
But these aggressive layoff plans hit a roadblock, right, from the judicial branch?
They did, yeah. A federal judge stepped in and temporarily blocked these mass layoffs.
On what grounds?
The judge cited serious concerns that the RIFs appeared politically motivated and were being conducted without proper procedural thought or, frankly, genuine operational need. Just cuts for cuts' sake, potentially.
And we got a really important clarification on that temporary restraining order, the TRO, just on Monday, didn't we?
Yes. Judge Ilston clarified a crucial point. The TRO protects any individual employee who is a member of one of the plaintiff unions.
Okay.
Even if the agency, like HHS or the CBC, has unilaterally terminated the collective bargaining agreement with that union. The judge basically said the order protects the members, regardless of the legal status of the union contract itself.
That sounds like it closed a potentially big loophole the administration might have tried to use.
Exactly. It prevents the agencies from saying, well, the contract's gone, so the TRO doesn't apply to these employees.
How did the government respond to that clarification?
They argued that figuring out exactly who was shielded by the order was an extreme burden, especially during a shutdown.
And the judge
swiftly dismissed that claim. She pointed out that the burden was created by their own strategic, aggressive decision to conduct mass layoffs during a funding crisis. The government was then mandated to update the court by noon Eastern time on Monday, detailing exactly how many employees were shielded by this clarified order. It effectively put a temporary halt to the purge.
Okay, so mass domestic layoffs are temporarily blocked by the courts, hiring is frozen by executive order, and at the same time, the administration is trying to re-engineer the flow of talent from outside the U.S. Let's talk about the H-1B visa situation.
Right. On Monday, USCIS issued some clarifying guidance about that presidential proclamation from back in September.
The one imposing that huge $100,000 fee for new H-1B petitions.
That's the one. A massive fee.
So what was the clarification? Did it ease some of the panic we saw in the tech sector?
It did, somewhat. The key clarification is that the $100,000 fee does not apply to existing H-1B holders who are simply changing jobs within the U.S., nor does it apply to foreign graduates already here, say, on student visas, transitioning to an H-1B.
Okay, so that avoids trapping existing talent.
It alleviates that immediate fear of widespread immobility among the current H-1B workforce. But the policy still acts as a really profound market intervention.
The administration's stated goal was to curb abuse by those big IT outsourcing firms, right? Is it doing that?
Well, it might have some effect there, but the collateral damage could be immense, especially for the high-growth innovation economy. Think about specialized fields like AI, where the demand for unique skills just massively outstrips the domestic supply.
How so?
For a giant outsourcing firm, tacking on $100,000 per visa might just be a cost of doing business, something they can absorb. But for a promising startup trying to hire one uniquely skilled AI engineer, that $100,000 fee is an existential barrier. It could kill their ability to hire that critical person.
And the knock-on effect is it stifles labor mobility, concentrates talent in the big established companies.
That's the key implication, yeah.
Yeah.
It creates this chilling effect. If you're an H-1B holder, maybe you're less likely to leave the stability of a huge tech firm for a riskier startup because you feel like your immigration status is just safer with a corporate giant that can weather any regulatory storm, pay any fee.
And industry groups are pushing back legally.
Oh, yeah. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already filed lawsuits.
What's their argument against the fee?
Their core legal argument is that the president exceeded his executive authority. This gets into administrative law. But essentially, they contend that visa fees have to be based on the actual processing cost of the application. That's based on longstanding Supreme Court precedent.
Not used as a policy tool.
Exactly. They argue this $100,000 fee isn't related to processing costs at all. It's being used punitively as an industrial policy tool to reshape the labor market. And they claim that's an unconstitutional overreach of executive power.
That's a fascinating collision right there. Trade policy, immigration, administrative law, all tangled up. Okay, so let's move from this aggressive reconfiguration of the domestic bureaucracy and talent pipeline and look outward. The executive branch has been just as busy on the global stage, hasn't it? Signing major trade deals, escalating military actions.
Extremely busy. Let's start with that U.S.-Australia Critical Minerals Pact. Signed Monday, October 20th, when President Trump met with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. This is arguably the most significant trade/industrial policy action we've seen in these 72 hours.
It creates an $8.5 billion investment pipeline. What's the big strategic shift here? What does this pact represent?
This is really a proactive industrial policy. It's aimed squarely at counteracting China's dominance in critical minerals and, importantly, their recent use of export restrictions on things like rare earths.
So, moving beyond just tariffs.
Exactly. For years, the U.S. strategy was mostly reactive tariffs, sanctions. This agreement signals a major shift towards building a parallel, resilient supply chain. The buzzword is friendshoring, building these crucial supply chains among trusted allies. The goal is to make the Western world less dependent on China for these essential materials.
$8.5 billion is a lot of money. Can you give us some specifics? Where's that investment actually going?
Okay, so the total commitment is $8.5 billion. That includes over $3 billion in joint U.S.-Australia funding that's supposed to be allocated within the first 6 months. So, quick action.
Okay.
The U.S. Exim Bank has also issued $2.2 billion in letters of interest, which basically helps de-risk key private sector projects. And maybe most crucially, the plan mandates investment in a specific facility, a 100 metric ton per year advanced gallium refinery in Western Australia.
Gallium. Let's pause on that. Why is gallium so important, and why is building this refinery such a key target?
Right. Gallium is highly strategic. It's a dual-use material. Yes, it's a key input for advanced semiconductors used in high-speed computing, but even more importantly for defense. It's essential for advanced defense tech.
Like what?
Things like stealth systems, advanced radar, critical components, and fighter jets. And right now, China controls something like over 90% of the world's refined gallium supply.
90%.
Over 90%. So establishing this 100-ton capacity in Australia isn't just industrial policy. It's an explicit, monumental gamble to create that necessary parallel supply chain. It's an acknowledgement that China's control over this one mineral poses an immediate national security vulnerability.
So the U.S. is essentially betting $8.5 billion that government financing can overcome China's massive head start, their entrenched advantages in cost, efficiency, and their history of things like price dumping.
That is the ultimate risk, yes. China has spent decades perfecting their vertical integration in these minerals. They've often accepted losses, used price dumping, specifically to eliminate competitors in the West. So the success of this whole pact really hinges on whether government support can nurture these new Western projects long enough for them to reach a competitive scale. It's not just about finding the minerals, it's about refining them economically.
How are markets reacting?
Interestingly, U.S. rare earth stocks actually responded pretty skeptically to the announcement. That suggests that private markets, at least for now, remain kind of unconvinced that this government push alone can quickly solve the sheer complexity and cost issues in the global supply chain.
Hmm. That puts quite a price tag on friendshoring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, turning from trade to more overt foreign policy and military actions, we saw a serious escalation in the drug war in the Southern Hemisphere.
We did. On Friday, the administration launched its seventh strike on an alleged drug boat, and they explicitly linked it to a Colombian terrorist organization. But then the rhetoric really escalated things. President Trump went on to Truth Social and publicly labeled Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, an illegal drug leader. And he threatened to cut all U.S. aid to Colombia and impose new tariffs, blaming Petro for failing to control drug production.
Wow. How did Colombia respond to being called out like that?
Swiftly and decisively. They immediately recalled their ambassador from Washington. That signals a major, major deterioration in diplomatic relations.
And it wasn't just Colombia.
No. Simultaneously, the U.S. ramped up military pressure elsewhere. Covert CIA operations were reportedly greenlit in Venezuela, which predictably prompted the dictator there, Nicolas Maduro, to mobilize his military forces in response.
So it feels like aggressive, preemptive, almost extrajudicial action is replacing traditional diplomacy and foreign aid in the region.
That seems to be the pattern emerging, yes.
Okay, shifting regions, the Middle East. The president claimed the ceasefire, the one brokered after the strike on Iran's nuclear capability, was holding.
He claimed it's holding, but it seems fragile. The agreement faced a really serious test on Sunday, October 19th. There were deadly Israeli strikes following renewed actions by Hamas militants.
So not exactly stable.
Not stable. Trump's response was characteristically tough. He threatened pretty violently intervention if Hamas militants didn't comply. He said they would be eradicated if they were to become, quote, rambunctious again.
Rambunctious. Okay. Yeah. And then finally, amidst all this global action, a sudden kind of strange domestic economic controversy popped up linked to Argentina.
Yeah, the Argentina beef import idea. Over the weekend, President Trump floated this highly unusual idea of importing beef from Argentina.
Why? What was the stated reason?
The stated purpose was to try and lower domestic beef prices here in the U.S. which are way up 13 to 16% higher than last year. That's causing real pain at the grocery store for consumers.
Well, wait, importing beef, doesn't that directly contradict his whole America First economic agenda, which relies heavily on tariffs to protect American producers?
It absolutely contradicts it. That's why it was so surprising. It really highlights a major political vulnerability for the administration right now.
Which is?
Rising costs. The GOP coalition, including key figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene, has been publicly expressing fear that high prices, especially for groceries, are really alienating voters. They understand people often vote based on their wallets.
So this was maybe a tactical move to address cost of living concerns, even if it temporarily undercut the America First message.
It looks like it. The administration seemed willing to risk that temporary philosophical contradiction on this one product, beef, to try and address this immediate pocketbook issue.
But the ranchers, they're a core part of the Trump base. How did they react?
Fiercely. They immediately pushed back. Ranchers called the proposal an absolute betrayal. They argued it would dilute the American beef market, undercut their own businesses, even though the current high prices are benefiting them.
So it's a really tricky political calculation. Lower beef prices might help with suburban voters worried about inflation.
But it risks alienating a critical base of rural producers. Yeah, it's fraud.
Fascinating how the price of steak suddenly gets tangled up with high-level trade policy and domestic politics.
Always does.
Okay, let's pivot back now to domestic conflict, but this time focusing on the judicial branch. We saw some significant rulings related to federal troop deployments.
We did. On October 20th, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals handed the administration a pretty major victory. They ruled that the president can legally deploy National Guard troops to Portland, Oregon.
Portland, specifically for the anti-ICE protests happening there.
Yes, specifically to help deal with the ongoing protests outside a federal facility there.
Now, doesn't that ruling kind of fly in the face of some earlier court decisions?
It does. Lower courts in places like Los Angeles and Chicago had previously ruled that similar National Guard deployments were illegal. But the Ninth Circuit decision stressed a really crucial legal distinction.
What was that?
They said courts shouldn't substitute their own assessment of whether the situation on the ground necessitated troops. Instead, the court must look at what the president actually did, the action taken, and determine if that action falls within the bounds of his executive authority to protect federal property.
So it's about the authority, not the necessity.
Primarily, yes. And this ruling provides a vital new legal precedent for the administration. It could potentially open the door for broader deployment authority in other cities facing similar prolonged civil unrest near federal sites.
How did folks in Oregon react, Democrats there?
Not well. Congresswoman Janelle Bynum immediately pushed back. She argued the protests were peaceful and said deploying troops felt like a flashback to 2020. She argued it fundamentally challenges First Amendment rights by using a military presence to essentially chill protest activity.
And meanwhile, the situation in Chicago is still ongoing.
Yeah, separate from the Ninth Circuit ruling, a federal judge in Chicago is still scrutinizing federal actions there. Questioning a Customs and Border Patrol official about reports of aggressive tactics, including federal agents allegedly pointing guns at bystanders during enforcement actions. So the legal battles over federal presence in cities continue.
Okay. And the Supreme Court also made a big move on the 20th, didn't they? Agreeing to hear a major Second Amendment case.
Yes, a really significant one. They agreed to hear United States v. Himani.
And what's that case challenging?
It challenges the constitutionality of a specific federal law, 922 G3. That's the law that prohibits firearm possession by anyone who is an unlawful user of controlled substances. Basically illegal drug users.
And this is all under the shadow of the Bruin decision from 2022, right? Which said gun laws have to align with historical tradition.
Exactly. Bruin requires that all gun laws must align with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation at the time of the founding. So the question becomes, is there a historical tradition supporting this ban on drug users?
How is the Department of Justice defending the law? What's their historical argument?
Their argument hinges entirely on finding what they call a historical analog. They argue that prohibiting drug users from owning guns today is analogous to founding-era restrictions that were sometimes placed on habitual drunkards.
Habitual drunkards.
Yeah. The historical context, they argue, allowed the government back then to disarm people who were deemed not responsible citizens or who posed a public danger due to their constant impairment.
But the person challenging the law, Himani, argues that's not the same thing.
Precisely. Humanities lawyers argue there's simply no founding-era tradition of disarming a sober citizen based purely on their past substance use or their status as a user. They draw a key distinction.
Which is?
Historical laws targeted people who were actively impaired, the drunkards. This modern law targets status being an unlawful user, which could potentially punish someone long after they last used any substance, even if they are currently sober and responsible. That distinction between active impairment and mere status is the huge legal pressure point here.
So this case could radically redefine who the government can legally prohibit from owning a gun under Bruin.
It really could. It's a landmark case for post-Bruin gun law jurisprudence. Definitely one to watch.
Okay. We also saw significant controversy bubbling up in the justice system itself related to political targeting and maybe the abuse of executive power. Let's talk about George Santos.
Ah, yes. Former Representative George Santos. He was released from prison on Friday after President Trump commuted his sentence, but the actual clemency order only became public on Monday.
And there was something unusual about it.
Highly unusual and controversial. The fine print is what's raising eyebrows. The clemency order explicitly states that Santos will not be required to pay any additional fines or restitution.
Wait, even though he was sentenced to pay restitution, how much was it?
He was sentenced to pay over $370,000 in restitution for wire fraud and aggravated identity theft convictions.
And the commutation just wiped that out.
Wiped it out. Clemency usually deals with the prison sentence length, maybe fines owed to the government. Wiping out court-ordered restitution owed to victims is extremely rare. It drew immediate legal scrutiny. It suggests the administration isn't just intervening in the punishment phase, but potentially undermining the judicial findings of financial responsibility to victims.
That's striking. And then there was the nominee to lead the Office of Special Counsel, the OSC, Paul Ingrassia.
Yeah, that nomination blew up on Monday. Democrats demanded his immediate withdrawal.
What's the issue? The OSC is pretty important, right? Handles whistleblower claims.
Critically important. They handle federal whistleblower protections, Hatch Act violations, discrimination claims. The integrity of the leader is paramount. The controversy exploded after reports surfaced alleging text messages where Ingrassia purportedly denounced the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and admitted to having, quote, a Nazi streak.
A Nazi streak? Seriously? How did his camp respond?
His lawyer dismissed the texts as just satirical humor, taken out of context.
But Democrats weren't buying that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They amplify their concerns by also bringing up previous unrelated sexual harassment allegations against him from a former workplace. They claim the nomination, combining the texts and the past allegations, shows contempt for the safety of women in the workplace and demonstrates an alarming lack of judgment for someone who'd be in charge of protecting federal employees from misconduct and discrimination.
Okay, a very controversial nominee. Finally, in this section on courts and justice, let's talk about what seems like blatant political targeting, withholding federal funds from blue states.
Yeah, this is a big one. The administration put a massive $18 billion on hold, money specifically allocated for major infrastructure projects, but only in Democratic states.
$18 billion? What kind of projects are we talking about?
Huge critical projects. Mm-hmm. Things like the Hudson Rail Tunnel, that's the vital gateway project connecting New York and New Jersey, and also New York City's Second Avenue subway extension. On top of that, they also canceled $7.6 billion in grants that were already approved for clean energy projects. Again, specifically in states that voted for Vice President Harris.
Just canceled them.
Canceled. Pulled the funding.
Now, this action, which seems like pure political revenge, actually drew some pushback from within the GOP itself.
It did, which was interesting. Several prominent Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski, Jerry Moran, Shelley Moore Capitos, they publicly criticized the strategy.
What did they say?
They argued pretty strongly that funding decisions should be based on merit, on the project's importance, not on politics. They warned that this kind of aggressive politicization sets a bad precedent. They worried it risks political retribution down the line when Democrats eventually regain power. They used phrases like petty revenge politics, arguing it would ultimately harm the country's infrastructure and institutional integrity.
But the administration, or at least allies like Senator Thune, defended the move.
They did. Thune, for instance, defended it by essentially saying it just mirrors the Democrats' own pure politics in keeping the government shut down over the ACA issue. It's like an eye for an eye justification, attempting to normalize targeted administrative retaliation by equating it with legislative strategy.
Which really sets the stage perfectly for our final segment, where politics seems to devolve into really aggressive rhetoric and administrative maneuvers that are pushing the boundaries of, well, decorum. Let's talk about those No Kings rallies.
Right. The No Kings rallies. They happened nationwide over the weekend.
Yeah.
Organizers claimed massive attendance. They cited an astonishing 7 million participants across the country.
7 million. Wow.
Yeah. Protesting what they see as the administration's authoritarian overreach. You had high-profile opposition leaders there, celebrities like Jon Bon Jovi, Democratic figures like Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders.
And the president's response went quite a bit beyond just verbal dismissal, didn't it?
Oh, profoundly beyond. It was aggressive and, frankly, pretty graphic. First, Trump and the White House attacked the protests verbally, calling them a joke, whacked out. Then, to mock the protesters' whole point about fighting authoritarianism, the White House actually posted official memes depicting Trump as a king.
Official White House memes of Trump as a king.
Official memes. But then the president himself escalated it dramatically on Truth Social. He posted an AI-generated video.
An AI video? Of what?
Of himself, wearing a crown, sitting in the cockpit of a fighter jet, spraying a brown liquid, which was widely interpreted as, well, excrement, onto the protesters below him.
He posted a video of himself spraying excrement on protesters.
An AI-generated video depicting that, yes. Yeah. Posted on his official social media platform.
How on earth was that defended?
How Speaker Mike Johnson defended it. He labeled it satire, said it was just intended to make a point. He tried to contrast it with what he claimed were protesters calling for the murder of his political opponents, though evidence for that specific claim was thin.
But that defense, it's satire to make a point, seems to highlight the administration's whole approach right now.
It really does. Their stated rules seem to be always be on offense, never apologize, never back down, always hit back harder. The fact that the official response to millions of citizens protesting perceived executive overreach includes posting a grotesque AI-generated meme like that, it really underscores how far political discourse has fallen, and frankly, what the White House legal counsel is now apparently willing to tolerate in official presidential communication.
It's quite something. Okay, beyond the rhetoric, we also saw some very tangible administrative headaches in action surface, particularly involving NASA and its big contracts with SpaceX.
Yeah, this was significant. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy issued a very public, very formal warning directly to Elon Musk.
About what?
Duffy stated that SpaceX's crucial NASA contract for the Artemis 3 mission, the mission to return humans to the moon, is in serious jeopardy because of persistent delays.
Jeopardy? What was the specific threat made?
Duffy explicitly warned he might open up the contract to competitors. And he specifically mentioned Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin by name. He emphasized that the U.S. just cannot afford delays in the new space race, particularly against China's lunar ambitions.
So it's an explicit public threat using a massive government contract to force a private company into faster compliance.
Exactly. Leveraging that contract very publicly.
And while the government is threatening private industry over space deadlines, back here on Earth, the White House itself is busy with some major construction.
It is indeed. Demolition actually began on part of the east wing of the White House.
Why? What are they building?
They're making way for the construction of a new, massive 90,000 square foot ballroom.
90,000 square feet. How much is that costing?
The expected cost is around $200 million. And the plan is to have it finished before the end of the president's current term.
So let me get this straight. While large parts of the federal government, including nuclear security, are literally unfunded and shutting down, the White House is starting a $200 million ballroom construction project.
That's the stunning parallel. Yes, massive, expensive construction proceeding rapidly while essential government functions grind to a halt due to lack of funding. The optics are striking.
Striking is one word for it. Okay, and on the security front, just briefly, the actual threat level facing the president seems to remain very high.
Extremely high. It's forcing the Secret Service to constantly adapt. The FBI is actively investigating a suspicious hunting stand that was found near Palm Beach International Airport.
What was suspicious about it?
It had a direct, unobstructed line of sight to the exact spot where President Trump would typically exit Air Force One when he lands there.
Wow.
Yeah. That discovery just underscores the intense, persistent threat level. It's necessitating the Secret Service to become much more unpredictable in their movements, implementing what they call asymmetrical planning, often changing protocols minute by minute just to enhance security.
Constant vigilance required. Finally, let's talk about the fallout from all these RIFs, the hiring freeze, the low morale in the federal workforce. It's actually spilling over into electoral politics now.
It really is. We're seeing this noticeable wave of former federal employees, people who were laid off or maybe felt pushed out, who are now running for Congress, mostly as Democrats.
And what are they running on?
Explicitly on platforms centered on protecting the civil service, countering the administration's cuts, and restoring what they see as lost expertise and integrity. We're seeing examples like Megan O'Rourke, a former climate scientist from the USDA, or Michael Duffin, who was laid off from the State Department.
Duffin? His campaign sounds particularly focused.
Yeah, he's really centered his campaign on making sure that laid-off federal employees have a voice in Congress. He's warning about the financial hardship, the mental health crises facing this highly expert workforce that's being dismantled, and the long-term risk of this brain drain.
But it's not just Democrats running, right? The political spectrum of former feds isn't uniform.
That's a really critical piece of context, yes.
Yeah.
We're also seeing people like Kim Farrington. She's a former CFO of both OPM and the USDA. She's running for office as a Republican.
And her platform.
She's actively applauding the administration's efforts, praising them for promoting efficiency, for trying to weed out what they perceive as fraud, waste, and abuse in the federal government.
So the battle for the future, the soul of the civil service, has now fully penetrated the political landscape itself.
Deeply. It's setting up these direct policy clashes and even personal conflicts between former colleagues right there in the upcoming election cycle.
Sam, this has been, well, an exhaustive look at just 72 hours of really profound institutional conflict and change. Let's try to synthesize this. What does this huge data dump truly reveal about the state of Washington right now?
You know, the core narrative here feels pretty unmistakable. The executive branch isn't just passively reacting to the legislative shutdown. It seems to be actively, assertively using it as both a political weapon and an administrative tool. The legislative paralysis, the gridlock, it's created this vacuum of power, maybe a vacuum of attention. And the White House is filling that vacuum aggressively, reconfiguring the government, pushing boundaries, setting up these high-stakes confrontations in the courts, on the international stage.
And the things we discussed, the hiring freeze, the mass RIFs, the continued shutdown, you're saying these aren't just random accidents of governance.
It's hard to see them that way. They feel interconnected. They seem to form a systemic strategy, one that clearly elevates executive authority and fundamentally tests that whole concept of a nonpartisan, merit-based civil service. It appears to be actively trying to substitute traditional competence with ideological loyalty.
And pursuing that strategy creates immense tangible risks.
Huge risks. Which brings us to maybe a provocative closing thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Consider this juxtaposition. We've seen this massive, proactive global trade shift, that $8.5 billion critical minerals pact with Australia aimed at securing future supply chains against China, launched on the very same day that the National Nuclear Security Administration furloughed 3/4 of its current nuclear security staff due to the shutdown.
Right, the same day.
So when the U.S. government prioritizes building a resilient future global supply chain, but simultaneously risks undermining the immediate safety and modernization of its own nuclear arsenal, what does that revealed choice, that prioritization, tell us about the true, immediate definition of national security in Washington today?
A vital and frankly pretty urgent question for a time when institutional risk feels perhaps higher than it's ever been. That wraps up this deep dive. Thank you for joining us.
We'll catch you on the next deep dive.